professional communities, they have a professional population, it certainly relates to those communities as well. So the topic that we're going to be discussing this morning, the way that I framed it was, is why are people in their 20s so distracted? A biblical framework for self-actualization. And, you know, we often get a sense that these individuals in their 20s, our college students, our young professionals, that they definitely are distracted. And we definitely get a sense that they are struggling. There's something innate there. There's something that we inherently connect with about that. And whether we are someone who are in our 20s, who are struggling and may not be able to necessarily put our finger on exactly what it is, the young professionals may not be able to exactly put our finger on what it is, or whether we're the parents of people who are in that stage of life, and we want to understand why we don't totally understand why they're struggling so much. Maybe we've forgotten certain things. Maybe certain things have changed. I think it's just a critically important topic to re-engage what it is that makes this time in life so challenging. Every stage in life has its challenges. The way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the way that God designed the world, is that we're meant to work here. Adam la'amal yulad. We were put in this world in order to work. And every stage of life has its unique challenges associated with that stage. But there are definitely unique challenges, heightened challenges, inherent to the stage of life that we're referring to as our 20s, which again, I'm thinking about as college students and young professionals. The most obvious distraction, as I flip forward on my phone, is technology. We're not going to talk about technology. Technology is the obvious one. Technology is the one to easily jump at. Technology is the one that so many other people in this conference this year and last year are talking about because we have to talk about technology. And I'm going to let those who are more qualified than me talk about technology in their own individual sessions. We know it's an issue. We know it's a struggle. We know that there are positives. We know that there are negatives. We know that it's a distractor 100%. Let's move past that. Both literally and figuratively, we're going to move on. And also, you can put your phones down for half an hour. It'll be okay. I'm not just my notes here, but that's the only thing I got is my notes up here. What I actually want to talk about are three more universal, fundamental, and intrinsic issues in their own way that are laid out by the Torah itself. And the source that we're going to discuss that brings forth these issues at first may seem out of left field, and then we'll quickly see how immediately relevant the source is to this topic. The source comes from Parshat Shoftim, middle of Devarim, which talks about what happens when the Jewish people go out to war. That's the context of these psukim. And the paragraph is only 9 psukim long. The paragraph reads as follows. Ki teitse la milchama levecha v'ra'ita sus v'rechev am rav mimcha lo tira mehem ki Hashem elokecha imach hama'alcha me'eretz Mitzrayim. When you go out to battle against your enemy and you see horse and chariot, a people more numerous than you, you shall not fear them, for Hashem your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. When you come close to the war, the Kohen will come forth and say, V'amar alehem, Shema Yisrael atem kredim hayom la'milchama alevechem, al yurach levavchem, al tiru v'al tach pezu v'al ta'artsu mipneem. It shall be that when you draw near to the war, the Kohen shall approach and speak to the people, and he shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, you are coming near the battle against your enemies. Let your heart not be faint. Do not be afraid. Do not panic, and do not be broken before them. When somebody tells you not to panic, that usually means you're about to panic, right? So don't worry. You're going to find a Kadosh Baruch Hu is with you. Why? Ki Hashem Elokeichem ha'olech imachem nilachem lachem imavechem lo'shia etchem. Doesn't say Benamara, I mean, that's in the Mishnah. For Hashem, your God, is the one who goes with you to fight for you with your enemies to save you. After the Kohen gets up and says, don't worry, go out, everything will be fine, God is with you, which is one of the big through lines of Sefer Devarim, as they prepare to go into Eretz Yisrael to remember that as we move away from the miraculous existence in the desert, even in the more down-to-earth reality of Eretz Yisrael, where there are no more overt miracles, there are only more subtle miracles, the miracles of everyday life, God is still with you, going to take you forward. After we emphasize that point, then somebody else gets up. And this is what we're going to focus on. Pasukei. V'dibru ha-shodrim el ha'am le'mor. The shodrim, the officers get up and say, Mi ha'ish asher bana vayit chadash v'lo chanacho. The officer shall speak to the people, saying, Who is the man who has built a new house and has not inaugurated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the war, and another man will inaugurate it. Umi ha'ish asher nata kerem v'lo chilalo, yilech v'yashov l'veito pen yamut v'milchama, v'ish acher yichalalenu. And who is the man who has planted a vineyard and not redeemed it? Let him go return to his house, lest he die in the war and another man will redeem it. Umi ha'isha sher aras, e'iras isha velo lekacha, ilech v'yashov leveito p'nyamut ha'milchama v'isha cher ikachenu. And who is the man who has betrothed a woman and not married her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the war and another man will marry her. So the Torah here identifies three things that would cause a person to go back from the battlefield, to go back for war. The Torah identifies three things, which understand the context here, which the Torah is saying, these three people, these three individuals, if they're relevant to any of these three categories, they can't go out to war, because if there is a chance, there is a chance that if somebody is coming at them with a sword, and they are looking at the whites of their eyes, and they are about to die, they will be thinking about something else. So overwhelming are these topics, so overwhelming are these concepts, that they just overtake a person. That they're so distracted by them that it could put them in personal danger. And certainly if somebody is banking on them for backup on the battlefield, they might totally miss it because their mind is somewhere else. What were the three topics that the Torah identified that are so distracting?
Getting married. So somebody engaged.
Marriage or being engaged.
House.
House and
garden.
Career, a job. Are poor people in their 20s, right? Think for a second. These three things that the Torah identified are perhaps the most distracting things, the most pressureful things, the most stress-inducing things. Our children in their 20s are struggling with, our students in college, our young professionals, these are the things which they are primarily struggling with in these years of their life. And I want to go through these one by one and spend a few minutes to try to understand a little bit deeper in what ways and how deeply are they struggling with these things that the Torah identifies as being those which are the most distracting things in life. The first one that the Torah brought up was building a house. So every year, for the last few years, I've had the great fortune of being able to go to Israel around May time. And I go and visit the yeshivas and the seminaries in Israel with the goal of, after all of the students have already decided what colleges they're going to meet with those students who are coming to our campus and to get to meet them beforehand to begin to create that connection. And then once that connection is established, also to prepare them for the transition from Israel into college campus life. And one of the things that I asked them, we divide that also into three different categories. We also talk about three categories. One of the things that I asked them is, in terms of the relationship in Anam L'Chaviro, I asked them, what is the most important interpersonal relationship that you are going to have over the next few years? And it's striking to me that almost never do the students in the room get the answer to that question. They guess a lot of things that some of you may be thinking. My parents, my answer to them is, of course your parents are important because you're chayav and kibud av va'im, and they will always be important to you, but that's not the most important relationship for the next few years of your life. My friends, if it's a really firm place, they'll say my spouse. I'm like, you've got time, it's okay. Right? See, I've got to tell you, the most important people for the next few years of your life are going to be your roommates. Your roommates. Those are the people you're going to be spending the most time with. Those are the people that you're going to be sharing things with. Those people who are going to create an avira in the first bayit that you're ever going to build. And I push them pretty hard to make sure that they meet with their roommates while they're still in Israel, or if their roommates are in Israel and they get back to the States, to meet before the first day of campus, if they can, or if they can't, on the first day of campus. To go and sit and have a meal together and talk about, what do you want your bayit to look like? Because there are a lot of things to think about. What kind of, do you want music blasting in the house or not? If you have music in the house blasting, do you want it to be good Jewish music or bad Jewish music? Because there's a difference. Everybody's got their own taste, but I think it's pretty different. Right, good Jewish music or bad Jewish music? Let's say it's Jewish music and non-Jewish music. Are you comfortable if they're playing non-Jewish music? Are there lines in terms of what words are being used? Music is one area. Television, do you want a television in your house? Does it even matter because you're all binging Netflix on your computer anyway? Or do we have to talk about a television? Comes up a lot with the guys' houses. Do you want to have a game system in the house or not? Do you want there to be, I'm sure I'm dating myself by saying Xbox, but do you want an Xbox in the house? Do you not want an Xbox in the house? Right? Kashrut. What's the standard of conscious awareness? It's a big question. And even if you both assume that you have high standards of conscious, you might have different piskei halacha. Do you need two ovens? Are you comfortable with one oven? That can be a stressor. My mom can tell you. It can be a stressor in the house. Right? That's even coming back to your own home, which was wrong because I was overkeeping off the aim. I shouldn't have done what I did. Saying it publicly. You have a lot to learn post-Israel before you figure out what we're talking about. Right? And when I've given this year to students, you know, we talked about ways in which to kosher your oven, if you need to kosher your oven and how. And there was one time somebody stood up and they said, no, there's only one way to kosher your oven. You have to triple wrap a piece of salmon and put it in the oven until it's cooked. I said, wow. I said, you know, maybe the person who gave you that psak wanted you to both kosher your oven and also make dinner at the same time. And that's really nice of them. And I was just kidding around, and then two other people said, no, that's how you do it. And I was like, you know what? It's all good. You're right. That's how you want to kosher. That will successfully kosher it if you want. And that's totally fine. But, you know, even if with kashrus, there are different standards and different piskei halacha. How do you want that to look? Yichud. Single people coming back, going to college and going on into young professional apartments. Yichud. Do you allow people of the opposite gender into the house, into the dorm room? If there's a common room, is it just to the common room but not into individual rooms? Does every single person get to make that decision on their own? I mean, these are big questions that are basically coming to the core of who am I? You think about what a house is. A house is very much a reflection of myself. When those of us who are married, when you're married, you look around the walls of the house, and you look around in the bookshelves of the house, look at how the house is structured. It's a reflection of the individual, it's a reflection of the couple. But you look at the walls, and you can tell a lot from a person. You know, you guys will never invite me over to your houses again, which is sad for me, but fine. The point is more important. The first thing I do when I walk into a house I've never been to before is I immediately start looking at the walls and the books. I like to process things. That's just the way that I work. And I find that I can learn so much about the person or about the family that I'm going to just by looking around. We went to interview schools. Because we had to interview schools. My kid's going into kindergarten, so she, of course, needed an interview because that's now what we do. So she was being interviewed, and while she was being interviewed, I went around, and my wife's like, why are you spacing out? I was like, I'm not spacing out. This is the principal's office. I'm looking at every sefer on his shelf. I'm looking at every picture on his shelf. I'm looking at which rabbis are on his walls. I'm looking at which books he has there. Because he's the person who's guiding the philosophy of the school, and I'm learning so much from that. But in a way, our house is a representation of who we are. And in those years, we're defining what do we want our first home to look like. If we are dorming or going to apartments in college, we're literally defining that space with our roommates. If not, then it'll come when we become a young professional and go to that first apartment, wherever that place may be. Right, in New York, it can often be in the Heights or on the Upper West Side, defining what that apartment's going to look like. Though it's a very stressful thing, what is my house going to be like? Is it properly reflecting me? Is it not? And who am I? It comes to the core question, who am I? And trying to figure that out. So a house is the first thing on the list. Second one, nata karen, which we said isn't just planting a vineyard, but choosing one's profession is such a stressful topic. And I don't know. I know what it was like 10, 15 years ago. Some of you know what it was like farther behind than that. What I get a sense is that literally as each year goes forward, there is more and more and more time that is required to be spent in school before you can get the job that you want. But what that means is that you have to commit really early on to what you are going to be doing for a very long time and not making any money off of it, which you will then be stuck doing for the rest of your life unless you make a huge career change. That's a really stressful topic. And when I'm talking to students, many, many students come to talk about what is my major. At Queens, they also tend, you can testify to this, to switch majors once a semester or once a year. That's a common theme in Queens. Nobody here in this room, per se, but many students in Queens can change their major from semester to semester, from year to year. And the college capitalizes on that. They make sure that there are a significant number of credits per major because they sort of take advantage of the students who keep jumping from major to major, that they keep getting them stuck in college because they can't graduate. Because even though they have 150 credits, they don't have all the credits for their major yet. Because they know that they're struggling to pick their major and they want to keep them. That's in Queens, even though the tuition is very low, that's where they make most of their money, is the undergraduate tuition. That's how they keep them. So I'm making a high number of credits per major. Because it's a stressful thing to figure out. What do I want to be studying now as my major? How much time do I want to be spending in graduate school? How much student loans do I want to take out? How much money do I want to owe later on? Is this something which I want to be doing for the rest of my life? Do I want to focus on something that's going to make me money? Do I want to focus on something that's going to support my family? Do I want to focus on something that's going to give me personal satisfaction in my work? Is there a way to find a combination of those things or not, depending on what I want to do? If I'm thinking about moving to Israel, is this now, on top of everything else, a career that's transferable? And when is it transferable? Is my undergraduate going to make a difference? Is my master's going to make a difference? Struggling to figure out, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? Something which, in our day and age, has also come to the forefront. When we meet somebody, we ask them, "Hi, nice to meet you. What's your name?" And the next question is,
"What do you do?"
And I love that you go to a place like Eretz Yisrael, like Israel, where there's, you know, there are more people there who are more spiritually inclined, I find, personally. And I once had a great response made to me. It says, like, "I'm an Oved Hashem, but during the day, this is what I do." Well, it's a very powerful statement, this concept that we've come to literally define ourselves by our work. We don't talk about whether we have a family first. We don't talk about our kids first. We don't talk about our personal interests first. We don't talk about our hobbies first. We don't talk about where we vacation first. We don't talk about what our priorities in life are first. What do you do? I am a. And I define myself as, I am an OJ Lester rabbi. I am a doctor. I am a lawyer. I am a nurse. I am a teacher. That's how I'm defining myself. And I'm deciding now what I think I'm going to want to be doing when I'm done 8 years from now. That can be an incredibly frightening challenge. It's something which does. I see it distracts students all the time. It stresses out students all the time. You know, when I was coming out of high school, so I had a deep interest in philosophy. Loved philosophy. And I was reading philosophy, like, intense philosophy works when I was in 12th grade. Yeah, I'm getting that look. Right? None of my parents were going anywhere near those books. None of my parents were anywhere near the books. Dad once saw it in the trunk. He's like, "I don't know what that is," and just closed the trunk and let it go. That was where I was at. And I went to Israel. When I went to Israel, I found that I was taken with Jewish philosophy. And I started to learn that, I started to love that, I started to get more and more into that over the 2 years that I spent in Israel. So when I came back, I, of course, took a philosophy class. I'm not saying that one should or should not take philosophy class. I'm talking about my own personal experience. I went to that philosophy class, and I'm sitting there, and I was so excited to get back into philosophy because I loved this. It was what kind of set me on a certain path. And we're sitting there reading Plato, and I'm like, I don't care anymore. And it was really striking for me. I didn't know that about myself. I don't care anymore. I don't care what he made up on his own that he thought was right when I could be learning Sfarim that I believe come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I want to know truth, not a possibility. That was how I saw it at the time, and I still see it that way now. And Rambam read Plato and he read Aristotle. I'm not saying that one shouldn't learn those things, but that was how I reacted to it. And then we got to Aristotle, which was dense and terse and super difficult to start to parse out. I was just so not interested. But I made it through the first third of the semester, almost. We learned Plato, we learned Aristotle on the first test, and I still remember this clear as day. And on the first test, there were going to be four questions. You had to answer three out of four essay questions. And so I was like, you know what? I read all the Plato stuff, I didn't read any of the Aristotle stuff, I'll go in, I'll answer two questions about Plato, I'll still pass, and then I'll figure out if I want to keep going. And of course, I show up to the test, and there was one question on Plato and three questions on Aristotle. So I sat down, I was like, you know, I'll just start, so I started to write, and I wrote for the Plato piece, and then I got to the Aristotle one, so I was like, I don't want to do this! And so I got up, I took the paper, I handed it in, I didn't say anything, I went out, and I dropped the class. Two interesting things happened after that. The first one is I went online, and I didn't know this is what you do. This is my first experience with it. I was like, I looked through the catalog and saw it was open. And I was like, I felt like there was something wrong. Like, I just, like, dropped the class, I clicked and dropped the class, and then I clicked and took a different class. And that was it. And I was suddenly in a different class. Now, that class happened to be Psychology 101, which I fell in love with and became a psychology major. And had I tried to get into that class earlier before somebody else dropped that class, I wouldn't have gotten in as a freshman. And I love psychology. The second one, which was kind of funny, is that the professor actually called me. He called me up a week later, and he left me just like, listen, I just want to talk to you. You handed in the exam. You wrote one beautiful answer that was one of the best answers I've ever read, and then you didn't fill out any of the answers on the test. And I just want to understand what happened. And I felt bad, so I actually met with him, and I tried to explain to him what I was going through, and I don't know if he understood or not, but we obviously parted ways after that. But it's a time of figuring out who I am and what I want, and that's just day one. That's semester one on college, let alone semester three or four or five or six. And moving along, again, picking your career, what you're going to be dedicating your life to in terms of your profession, that's a very, very stressful thing to be thinking about. Let's jump to number three, which was the primary topic of last year's discussion, Eres Isha, getting married. So I'm glad the Torah put it third on the list, so we didn't spend the whole time just talking about this one piece. I mean, this is obviously, perhaps, the most important decision that a person will make over the course of their life, is who they're going to spend the rest of their life with. If that weren't bad enough, the system changes constantly and it gets so much more difficult and so much worse, and so it's just so hard for people to try to just find the right person and get married. It gets more challenging as you continue to go along year by year. I watch it. I've watched myself. I've been in OEJLIC at Queens College for 6 years. And I've literally watched over the last 6 years the phone calls that I get about students when I'm put as a reference for students. The nature of the questions that I get asked has changed even in the last 6 years. So many more people are talking about shidduch resumes. That was something which didn't fully exist in my time, in the circles that I was dating in, when I was dating. It was something which I would say maybe half of the students were doing when we started on campus. Now it's an assumed. Now it's something that you definitely are doing. What's on those resumes, they can get so long and so detailed, and everybody suffers from the system. The girls suffer from the system because it is a guy's world in the shidduch world, which is unfortunate but true, and there are a lot of reasons for that, which I'm sure, again, also other speakers will talk about. But it's a guy's world in terms of choosing from, and so the guys have gotten into really negative habits of trying to look for the exact person that they want to marry and the person that's perfect in their mind who they want to marry, which, as it turns out, doesn't exist. But they haven't figured it out yet. And so these girls are suffering and not meeting their bashir, not being able to go to their date to them because they know they can, because they have 50 resumes that are flooding their inbox. And so they have no choice. Internally, they end up getting stuck in this place of, well, how do I figure this out? I have to compare and contrast. And then it becomes this vicious cycle of getting more and more and more refined and thinking that they're going to find the exact thing that they think they want instead of finding the person that they need. And it's hurting the guys a lot. And we're not training our guys about what it means to look for a relationship, what's important, truly important in a relationship, and how to date like a mensch in order to get married, because they're not getting married either. They might be dating more, but they're not getting married either. And on the flip side, because of the negative outcome of that system, on the flip side, is that the girls are struggling to get dates because you have 20 people who are all looking at the same guy. And I get multiple phone calls again and again and again. If we have a good guy that comes out of Queens and he puts me as a reference, those are the guys I get the most phone calls about. There's one or two guys right now I'm getting one call a week, which means he's definitely not dating every single one of the guys that I have to describe him to, and I've got it down. I have my elevator pitch for him at this point. Like, I get calls again and again and again, and he's a very sweet guy, and he's a very special guy. But I genuinely believe that there are a large number of our students who are just as special in their own way. Amongst the guys, and certainly amongst the girls. And the questions that I get asked can be painful. Like, just they're striking to me. I got a phone call the last week from a parent. I don't know whom. And the way this sometimes can go is like I get a phone call and people say, I want to ask about so-and-so, and I've learned, I don't ask, it's not my business. So I don't know who's calling me. I figured out it was the father of a boy, father of a boy asking about a girl, father of a boy asking about a girl. And like, with no sense of remorse, just asking the most boxy questions. You know, what type of girl is she? Is she Five Towns, Brooklyn, Manhattan, or Ohio? Those are my options. It was multiple choice. It was multiple choice. And I said, like, I'm not really sure how to answer that. I mean, I can tell you she's from the Five Towns. I don't know if she's necessarily a quote-unquote typical Five Towns girl. To which he responds, and I figure you'll all appreciate this being where you are. To which he responds, oh, so you're saying she's not Jappy. And I was like, I didn't say that she's not, but that's not what I said. I'm telling you geographically where she's located. I didn't tell you about her personality. You know, he says to me, how tall is she? I said, I honestly don't know. I've never sized her up before. I really apologize. I said, I'm 5'10". I think she's shorter than me. She's shorter than 5'10". And he goes, Yeah, I mean, most girls are shorter than 5'10". Fine. He's like, okay. I hope it's okay to say this on recording. He says, of course it's recorded. I think it's okay to say this on recording.
Yeah, it's fine.
He says, but again, people should realize that you, when you hear this, hopefully hear yourself asking these questions and don't ask these questions. He says to me, you know, well, let me, like, is she pretty or is she a knockout? And I said, I'll be honest with you, if I was thinking about my students that way, I couldn't be in the job that I'm in, so I genuinely can't answer that question. To which he responded to me by saying, like, listen, you're going to have to stop with the PC answers and start giving me some information. Because he can. Because he's the father of a boy asking about a girl. And we have to get out of this. But what that means for our students, focusing now on the people in their 20s, what that means is, can you imagine, try to put yourself back in that place with all of this stuff on top of it. How you have to think about yourself, every external piece of yourself. How do I present? What am I wearing? What am I doing? What are my extracurriculars? What am I doing on my free time? Who am I talking to? Who's watching me talk to them? How am I interacting? Every aspect of how I dress, of how I look, of where I go is being scrutinized. Every single thing. And you know what we haven't even gotten to yet? Who the person is. Then they got to figure out, oh, and in addition to how I present myself and how I'm putting myself into the world so I can hopefully get the shidduch thing down, who am I and what do I want? And they're not even thinking about that because everybody's only asking about the externalities. The pressure of trying to find that person is overwhelming. And as it gets drawn out because of the brokenness of the system, it's something which is dragging out into its mid, late 20s, 30s. Because it's so stressful and because we're responding to that stress by asking and answering the wrong questions.
You know, I'm married over 30 years, so, like, you know, it was so much more relaxing and fun when we were dating years ago, and we didn't have to worry about any of this stuff.
Right.
Okay, you know, grew up modern Orthodox, from modern Orthodox. Now I find that it's very tense, and it's not fun for a lot. It's not fun for them. It's just a bad situation.
I love that. It's always like the newbie parents when they call me to ask about somebody in school the first or second time they're making the phone call. Like, isn't this supposed to be fun? I'm like, you'll learn. You'll learn. Your kids, if it's not that mom's block, your kid will get married soon, but you'll learn that it's a stressful process with a great outcome. That's the goal. But yeah, it's very, very different. It's something which, again, as people who have children who are going into or in their 20s, to get into that headspace, that these things are distracting them. That it's not just the phones, that it's not just the world, that when they're not returning our phone calls as frequently as we would like, that's only one thing that's on their mind. When they're not calling every Friday like they should, as parents, we need to mechanic our children, that they need to call us every Friday and to keep a relationship with their parents, but to be understanding of the fact that their minds are elsewhere. When they neglect responsibilities in the home as they've moved out of the home for the first time and are trying to figure out what is their home versus their home. The home I came from versus the home I'm going to. My family that I came from versus the family that I'm trying to build. Watching my parents earn money and have a profession versus myself figuring out how I'm going to have my own profession. That they're struggling with these things and that these things are taking a tremendous amount of their time, of their mental energy, of their effort. This is where their minds are at. And to, again, still be parents and mechanic then that they need to keep other things prioritized as well. But to remember what the Torah is telling us here. The Torah is telling us that if these people, the people who we would tell without any question to not go out to war with us, because we can't even trust them to be focused on their own lives, would be college students and young professionals. Which would be really bad in war times because they're the ones we usually put on the battlefield. They're usually the youngest and the strongest and the fastest. So we would have a big problem. Because kids grew up a lot faster back then. And there's a protracted state of growing up that's continuing to get longer and longer and longer in our generation. So while we expect them to be in a certain place, to respect where they are, you know, I don't think he's speaking this year. He's spoken in previous conferences. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Is Dr. Pelkovic speaking this year at the conference?
Not this year.
He's unfortunate. He's amazing. If you haven't heard him, you must hear him. He's unbelievable. And one of his key phrases is, to name the monster is to conquer it. And I want to help us name that. To name what we're going through as people in our 20s, or what our kids are going through in their 20s, because to name the monster is to conquer. To recognize that these are three things which the Torah identifies as being the most distracting, and that our children at this stage of life are struggling with all three of them in the most intense way in the history of the Jewish people, all at the same time, all in this time of life. And we'll end with this. The Torah doesn't even technically end with that as well. It goes one step further. the Chumash ends off by saying that there's one last group of people. We're not going to talk about it. I just want to leave it as kind of the exclamation point on the discussion. The Asfu HaShotim Ladaver Al Ha'am Ve'amru, the Shotim get up and add one more thing and say, Mi Ha'ish Hayarei Barach HaLevav, who is the person who is fearful and their heart is weak? Yilech V'yashev Lo Yitzo, they should go back to their house also. Everybody's weak. Nobody wants to go out to war. War is a frightening place. Rashi quotes a Gemara in Sota, which says, what does it mean, he who is fearful should go back? That that's a person who has averas in their hands and is afraid that their averas are going to cause negative harm to them on the battlefield, that God won't be with them. And it's intentionally written in a subtle way so as not to embarrass those who are actually turning back because they know that they've sinned, they're struggling with their relationship with God, and that's why they're leaving the battlefield, is because they don't know if God's moving them, because they don't know if they're connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the right way. And underlying all of these three things is that it's something which the Torah is super sensitive to, so as to even frame it in such a way that it's framed very carefully and very quietly, and also to allow them that when all of those three groups of people walk away, they can sneak away with them and nobody will know that why they're actually walking away from the battlefield. But obviously in this time of life, our kids are struggling with their religious identity. They've left the house with the sins that they have come to commit as they've explored currently, with the religious growth they aspire to and what they've achieved or not achieved, what they've accomplished or not accomplished. Underneath it all is desperately trying to figure out their own religious identity amongst all of that. We've got to support our kids. My job on campus is to understand them. My job on campus is to be that support. But almost all of my students look up to their parents. And even the ones who don't, it's only because there's such a broken relationship that they don't think that they look up to their parents right now. But hopefully one day that they will again. And one of the ways that we can support them is, again, understanding what they're going through, being sensitive to it, and then opening up dialogue about these things, not in stressful ways. Don't ask them, what's your major? How's school going? How are your classes going? Is this something which you're finding interesting? Ask them non-intimidating questions. And if they push back, say, it's okay. I know it's a tough time. If you want to talk about professions, I'm happy to talk to you. If you want to talk about religiosity, I'm happy to talk to you. But open the door for it and let them know they have a safe, non-stressful environment. One of the reasons why our kids shut us out is because they think that if they come and talk to us about it, we're going to pressure them more and they will shut down. Open up to them, create a safe forum for them to talk with us because we have so much to share with them and so much guidance to give them and so much love to give them. And Bezrat Hashem, we can help them in this difficult but empowering and ultimately rewarding time of their lives. If we're there for them, we support them, we create that open.